Okay, so thanks for coming along and listening to this. This will actually follow on quite nicely in some ways from what we were talking about at coffee. And so the title I gave this talk today is What I Cannot Create, I Do Not Understand, which sounds a little fancy. It was actually something that was written on Feynman's blackboard at the time of his death, along with such things as know how to solve every problem that has ever been solved. Yeah, this one's good. A man of modest ambitions, right? But so I don't know exactly what he meant by this, but I take it to mean that if we're trying to model the universe, if we're trying to understand galaxies or galaxy clusters, then if we claim that we understand theoretically how that process works, then the only way to really demonstrate that that is that we've really understood things is to use that knowledge to create something which looks like the real universe, to essentially build a model universe that is hopefully indistinguishable from the one which actually exists. So this is something I've been thinking about a lot for the last few years, and what I want to talk to you about today is a toolkit that I've put together that hopefully goes some way towards facilitating this kind of process. And I'll get into that more in a second. I'm going to talk to you a bit about the actual toolkit and intersperse that with some interesting science results that have come out of it, just so you know, I actually tell you some interesting science as well. I'm more than happy to answer questions. You know, if I don't get to the end, I don't care. Just ask me questions if you have ones you want to know the answer to. So before I go on, I should mention the people I'm collaborating with on some of the science results I'm going to show you. So Annika Peter, who is a postdoc at UC Irvine. Arif, who's just walking the door at the right time. John Carpenter, who's research faculty at Caltech, and Aparna Venkatesan, who is at the University of San Francisco. I'll mention them again when I sort of get to the work that's relevant. So what's my motivation here? Well, the questions that I'm really interested in, which I think are similar, at least in part, to many people in this room, is basically how do galaxies form and evolve? Okay, so a big question and rather vaguely defined, I think, but to make it just a little bit more precise, I would say what I want to understand are what are the physical processes that are at work in determining how galaxies form, how they change over time, which of those processes are most important, and you know, how do they all fit together, how do they interact? That's the kind of questions I want to get at. And I think we're kind of fortunate at this point that there is a pretty well-established standard model of this whole process of galaxy formation. And I put this in quotes because it's, you know, the particle physics standard model is far from perfect, but I think ours is even less perfect. But nevertheless, we have this idea of galaxies forming by baryons condensing inside a merging hierarchy of dark matter halos. And there's a lot of evidence which suggests that's really what's going on, even if we don't know all of the details. So we have this kind of standard model, even if there are gaps in our knowledge. And that's great, because that means we can start to ask questions about it. The obvious question is, well, is it correct? And the obvious answer is no, because I just already said that there are gaps in our knowledge, there are things we don't understand perfectly. So perhaps the better question is, well, where does it fail? Where do things not work? That's going to be where it's most interesting. We can actually try to then understand why our theoretical modeling failed and maybe how we can improve it. And I think, again, another big sounding statement here, but basically we want to ask the question, do our models explain all known phenomena? And I should probably add about galaxies, not everything else. And I think this is important because this process is complex, galaxy formation is a complex process, and because there are gaps in our knowledge, it's pretty easy for me to cook up a model which, say, fits the distribution of stellar masses of galaxies in the universe. It's pretty easy to cook one up which gets the right distribution of sizes for galaxies. If you ask me to do those two things simultaneously, it's a lot more difficult. So you really want to look for models which can describe, as much, if not all, phenomena about galaxies as they possibly can in a consistent and coherent way. So I think my conclusion after asking these questions is that what we really need is a coherent framework in order to calculate expectations from our sort of standard model of galaxy formation. Basically, what I mean by that is, we have these theoretical ideas, but if you want to ask the question, well, how many galaxies of a given luminosity would I see out to redshift 3? So you can actually compare that with some observational data. We need a framework that allows you to calculate that. And I'm not claiming this is a particularly novel insight. Obviously, people have understood this before. But what I've been trying to do is to build a framework which actually makes this easy and allows, you know, anybody who's interested to do it and ask the questions that they want. So this is something I've been working on for the last couple of years, and the result of it is a galaxy formation package called Galacticus. So I'll describe it in a little bit more detail in a second. I like to not call it a galaxy formation model because I think that implies a sort of fixed static thing which makes a bunch of predictions and that's it and is either wrong or right. So I prefer to think of it as a galaxy formation toolkit. It's a set of tools which allow you to ask questions about the universe in terms of galaxies and how they form and evolve. And more than that, you can pull out pieces of it and plug it into other calculations or add to it and extend it. So it's designed to be very flexible. When you put all these pieces together, it does form a coherent model which attempts to explain, you know, a large number of properties of galaxies. So I'll spend just a few minutes talking about it, and then I'll get onto some science results as well. So a few features of this toolkit. The first is that it's modular. I think this is important because our knowledge of galaxy formation is always changing and expanding as we learn new things and we get better understanding. And this modular nature allows you to just plug and play with different pieces. You can, you know, if you don't believe in AGN feedback, we'll just delete that module and it will, you know, work happily without it. If you have a better idea of how feedback works, you know, you can go plug that in and see what the consequences are. So it really allows you to explore physics and new ideas. It's a pretty comprehensive model. I'll come back to this in a second. Basically, meaning it includes pretty much all of the physics that you'd expect from this kind of modeling and is rapidly gaining more and more. It's as detailed a model as we can currently construct. It's also very well documented. You can get documentation online that explains, you know, how to install it, how to run it, how to analyze the data that comes out of it, how to modify it, everything you want to know. And I think importantly, it's an open source code. So you can actually go download this, look at it yourself. I can talk for hours about why I think this is a good idea for scientific software, but the bottom line is that these models are complicated. And if I or somebody else publishes a result using it, and you look at it and you think, well, that doesn't really make sense to me, well, you can go and look in this code and, you know, dig around and discover that, you know, there's a factor of two missing, and then, you know, that's good. We can learn what's wrong and try to fix it. And my other goal with this toolkit is to really try and keep it as current and optimal as possible by always working to include the current best calibrations of, you know, different, you know, scaling relations that are fed in, and our current best understandings of the physics, so that it's always as up to date as possible. I think that's important. Even though we know there are gaps in our understanding, you still want to do the best job you possibly can. So I'll just spend another minute or two talking in a little bit more detail about some of those points. So let me come back to this issue of it being modular and extensible. So what do I mean by that? Well, as you'll see in a second, it represents a galaxy, or I should say more precisely, the galaxy and its associated system of dark matter and any surrounding corona of gas is a collection of physical components. You know, a physical component might be a dark matter halo, it might be a galaxy disk, it might be a supermassive black hole. And this toolkit is designed to allow you to add to that. You can easily plug in your own physical component. Right now, there's no diffuse stellar halo, for example. So if you're interested in that, well, you just write down the differential equations that describe its evolution, plug them in, and it will go ahead and solve for what happens with that component. You can also add different implementations, like if you don't like the way I've set up galaxy disks, you could add your own and switch between them however you see fit. Likewise, pretty much every function in the code, whether it's, you know, the cosmological expansion versus time relation, or cooling functions, or the rate of star formation in galaxy disks, are all entirely modular and extensible, so you can, you know, add in your own version again, you know, switch between them, and basically designed to allow you to do things however you want and to explore new ideas. In terms of actually running this thing, it's parallelized right now under OpenMP, so you can make use of multi-cores. I have an MPI version which is almost working, I think, so hopefully that will be ready fairly soon. It's also very robust. So I regularly run this for, you know, millions of galaxies with whole varieties of different input parameters, and it works. It's very stable. It very rarely crashes. So that's good if you want to do big parameter space explorations.
What language?
So it's most of the infrastructure is written in Fortran 2003, but in terms of these modules and functions, you can add them on in either Fortran or C. There's a pretty much coherent set of interfaces for the two languages. And there's also a growing suite of test cases. Like I said, these codes are inevitably complicated. I think if you don't test them and put together a bunch of tests which try to check that you're getting the right answer, you're inevitably going to have errors and bugs in the code. So this gets run every night on my computer back at Caltech, and it sends me nasty emails if something goes wrong. So I mentioned that it models things as a set of components that describe individual galaxies. So these include things like dark matter halos, the hot atmospheres of gas, which are cooling to form galaxies, disks, spheroids, and supermassive black holes, along with a couple of things which just track sort of internal properties and other things like spin of dark matter halos. But these are basically the five components that are in there right now. Like I said, you can extend this easily. You just specify the differential equations that describe how these things evolve. But this is already fairly complete. This is kind of what's included in most comparable semi-analytic models. So you can do interesting calculations about morphologies and gas content of halos, stellar masses, and so on. In terms of the physics that's included in there, there's a lot already. So dark matter structure formation, either from embodied simulations or analytically. Gas cooling, the formation of disks by conservation of angular momentum as gas cools and collapses. Merging of galaxies, supernova feedback, the growth and merging of supermassive black holes. What else? Instabilities of disks, AGN feedback, calculations of the sizes of galaxies using adiabatic contraction. And then, of course, stellar population synthesis to convert from star formation rates into luminosities, and processing through dust so you can calculate both extinction due to dust and also re-emission from hot dust, as I'll talk about a little bit later on. So it's very comprehensive, and you can get measurable physical properties out of this model easily. Again, I'm going to talk in a second about some of the physics that is missing, but this is already, I think, very comprehensive and allows you to do interesting real-world calculations. So just to self-promote, I guess, here's a map of download activity. So this code was released in August last year, so this is download activity since then. In 238 cities, you can kind of trace out areas of active astrophysical research, Western Europe, Japan, a bit of Australia, New Zealand, South America, and North America here. And if you zoom into the US, some of you can probably pick out your own home institutions, and if not, go back there and download it. This one's me, mostly, but the rest of them are other people. So it's been downloaded and made use of a lot already. So I wanted to spend a few minutes, since this is a program on cluster physics, talking about what's actually in the model right now in terms of physics relevant to clusters. Perhaps more importantly, I want to be completely open here and say there's a lot of things which are missing and are on my to-do list for the next version, which are relevant to the cluster environment. So I'll talk about those and what I'm going to do with them. None of them are particularly difficult to implement. It's just a case of finding time to do it, so they will eventually happen. So here's my spherical cow galaxy cluster, dark matter halo. So the physics that is included right now, so first of all, AGN feedback. If you form a galaxy with a big black hole in the middle of this thing, it will dump energy into the surroundings, offset cooling in that gas, and that's important for shutting down galaxy formation in these massive environments. So that's all included using the work that Arif and I did a year or two ago. Of course, it includes the buildup of substructure inside dark matter halos, so you have this whole merging tree of systems. You get subhalos forming inside these clusters. One of the environmental effects that is included is so-called starvation. So any hot corona of gas that this guy has will be stripped away as soon as it falls into this cluster. I'll eventually put in a more realistic calculation where that happens over a timescale. Yeah?
Sorry, is this 1B?
So don't think of it in terms of 1D, 2D, 3D. It's not like doing an M-body or an SPH-type simulation. Think of this in terms of a set of analytic semi-numerical rules that you apply to figure out how these systems evolve. So for example, I can be a little more specific. a galaxy disk is modeled as an axisymmetric exponential with some, you know, with a fixed radial profile. So it's not, so it's characterized by just a few numbers, a radius, an angular momentum, a stellar mass. And you write down equations which explain, you write down differential equations which govern how those quantities evolve, and then you go ahead and solve them. It's very flexible, and as I'll come to in a minute, you could extend that. You could model a disk as a set of concentric shells if you wanted. So then you start to have something more like a 1D solver and solve those individually. So it's designed to allow you to, you know, go into whatever level of detail you want to. But the current implementation, you know, think of it as, you know, I guess, 0D, a set of scalar quantities.
Because you're painting onto like dark matter simulations? Is this what you're doing?
So you can do this either way. So again, because of the way it's designed, you can feed in a merger tree, for example, so a representation of merging dark matter halos in multiple ways. So you could take one you've extracted from a simulation, and there are, you can, it's set up to read ones from the Millennium simulation right now, or it has internal routines to construct them statistically and process the same those trees in the same way if you want to. And I'll show that in a second, actually. And like with everything else, you could plug in your own version of doing that if you wanted. So. Let's see, so a few things which are not included, but eventually will be, and hopefully not too distant future. So tidal truncation, it would be nice to have that in there to see how that affects cluster galaxies in particular. And you know, if you actually have a galaxy living inside this subhalo, you might want to worry about ram pressure, stripping of its interstellar medium as well. That's something which has been included in other comparable models and will eventually get put in here. What else? Right now, there's only a single level of subhalo hierarchy. So you have subhalos, but not sub-subhalos. Of course, that's incorrect. In CDM, you get multiple sub-sub-sub-subhalos going all the way down the hierarchy. That's just sort of a convenience. When I first wrote the code, it's easy to generalize that, essentially. So you'd have multiple levels of this substructure hierarchy. The only tricky bit is figuring out when this guy should get promoted out of here into the larger cluster potential. You know, if this thing gets stripped apart, you'd want that to happen. But that can be figured out. I plan eventually to re-implement the work I did back in 2002 and actually modeling the orbits of these substructures in more detail, where you follow their orbits around, including dynamical friction, tidal mass loss, tidal shock heating, and so on. So you get a much more realistic picture of the subhalo distribution. And allows you to treat things like tidal stripping and ram pressure stripping in more detail. Yeah?
So if you keep tracing a bunch of scalar quantities, is this a statistical description of the orbits that you're doing? Or
so in
each of the satellites individual scalars with their own properties at all?
Right. So at the simplest level in this case, you'd assign each subhalo some orbit, you know, some orbital parameters, and then you would you would track its XYZ position as it orbits around in this potential. If you have an embody simulation that you feed in, you could actually give it the orbital parameters from that embody simulation and use that as the orbit, right? You could actually track its orbit from one step to the next. That only really works well if you have a simulation with enough outputs where you can resolve that orbit well enough. So this is useful. Yeah. This basically allows you to solve that same question if you don't have enough resolution, time resolution in the simulation. But again, you can do it either way. Whether the position of the subhalo comes from integrating its orbit or whether it comes straight from an embody simulation, the code will handle that just the same. And I guess the one last thing was what I was talking about earlier, and this is the work with Arif. Just to demonstrate the flexibility of this code, you can plug on an entire 1D solver on top of this whole framework, follow the buildup of this gas as it falls in and shocks and then cools into the center. Of course, that will slow things down. You might not want to do that on a sample of a few million galaxies, but this, you know, is nice to allow you to explore isolated, you know, interesting test cases. And obviously, you've already got the whole framework of gas cooling rates that you can make use of. So I wanted to not just talk solely about modeling and actually show you some interesting science results. This one is somewhat relevant to clusters, although I'm going to talk mostly about the local group of galaxies. But it just demonstrates different ways of using the code, and part of what I want to try and do is show you what it can do, and then you can see if it might be of any use to you. So this is work that I did with Annika Peter, following up on some earlier work she did looking at simple models of decaying dark matter. so the idea is, suppose you start out with some dark matter particle X, which can actually decay into some nearly degenerated mass particle Y and some almost massless counterpart. And we were really interested mostly in this as just a phenomenological model, since, you know, obviously we don't know what dark matter is. But you can sort of motivate it from supersymmetric type models if there's a gravitino, and another particle with almost the same mass. But we really were more treating this as just a phenomenological description of a decaying dark matter model and figuring out its astrophysical consequences. So what are the astrophysical consequences of this? Well, basically, when this decay happens, this particle Y, this decay relic, we'll get some small non-relativistic kick in velocity. So in the rest frame of this particle X, the Y and its counterpart shoot off in opposite directions. The Y moves off with a small velocity kick. And if you imagine a dark matter halo in which these particles are decaying, you can think of that as adding kinetic energy into the halo. Every time one of these particles decay, it gets a little kick in velocity. That's injecting energy into the halo. And so generically, the halo will expand. You pump in energy, it will expand. The central density will drop somewhat. And if you pump in too much energy, you might actually unbind the entire halo and destroy it. So we wanted to ask, what constraints can we place on this using astrophysical observations? And so this model is described by just two parameters, basically this kick velocity, vk, and a decay time, so the time scale for the x to decay into the y. So it's a nice, simple, well-defined model. And what we wanted to do was to look at what constraints we can get from the local group dwarf galaxy system. It's kind of funny in some ways. These kind of models were originally motivated to explain the relative paucity of dwarf satellites around the Milky Way. Of course, in the last few years, this is a plot from Malajiha. In the last few years, a lot more of these have been found, such that now if you kind of extrapolate the whole sky and make corrections for incompleteness, there are probably 200 or so satellites around the Milky Way, and therefore we think at least 200 or so subhalos orbiting the Milky Way that were able to form a galaxy. So we kind of turn the question around and say, well, given what we know about this population, what constraints can we place on this kind of dark matter model? And you can go a little bit more stringent than this and say, well, not only do I need at least 200 subhalos in which to form my observed galaxies, but they have to be sufficiently massive that they can form stars. If they form no stars, they're dark and you can't see them. Don't have to form many stars, maybe only a few hundred, but you've got to form some. And also did a nice work by Louis Strigari. We know that all of the observed dwarf galaxies seem to contain a lot of dark matter in their inner regions. In particular, he showed that they all contain somewhere in the region of 10 to the 7 solar masses in their inner 300 parsecs. So in order to be a viable dark matter candidate, any decay model we come up with should produce 200 subhalos that can form stars and have at least, you know, 5 times 10 to 6 or more solar masses of material in their inner 300 parsecs. And that's going to just constrain the decay model because, like I said, as you pump in energy by decays, you reduce the central density in the halos. So Annika actually did a bunch of work on this. She ran some idealized simulations and did some analytic calculations to figure out the evolution of subhalo density profiles for a given decay model, so you can actually, you know, see how it affects them. So what we did was to take the Galacticas toolkit and use it to generate tens of thousands of realizations of Milky Way-like systems. You know, build their merger trees, look at all the substructure that forms and accretes into them, and then for a given set of decay parameters, figure out which of those subhalos meet these criteria and just count up how frequently we get at least 200 such subhalos. And that allows us to say whether such a decay model is plausible or implausible given the observational constraints. So here's the kind of thing that we find. What you're looking at here is just number of galaxies per Milky Way from 1 here up to 10,000. And this on the y-axis is just the cumulative probability in our tens of thousands of realizations of getting that number. The point here is just the, you know, estimated local group abundance. And that number's, you know, pretty uncertain, but it's somewhere around here, 200 or so. So in this case, this is for pure cold dark matter with no decay. You see you always form at least 500 or 600 subhalos which are able to both form stars and have this much mass in their inner regions.
This is based on, simulations, or is this based on
Inesto density profiles?
I mean, like, you know,
You mean what the...
The number of satellites or whatever, right? So this is based on like press checkers?
This is based, okay, good question. So this is based on a modified press checker, which is tuned to match the progenitor mass functions from simulations. So statistically speaking, at least in that first order statistic, it agrees with our body simulations.
Which were your constraints on the halo? What do you call the Milky Way halo? It's just the mass?
Right, so we actually explored a range of mass here. So from around 10 to the 12 up to about 2 times 10 to the 12 virial mass, because, you know, obviously it's somewhat uncertain. I'm just showing you results here for a sort of a median mass, to keep it simple, which, yeah, that will cause this line to shift slightly either way, but it doesn't really change the results significantly. So cold dark matter, not surprisingly, is perfectly consistent with the observed number. You always form at least 500 or so. Sometimes you get a couple of thousand of subhalos, which can actually host these galaxies. If I switch on some decay, so if I go to a decay time of 20 billion years and a kick velocity of 5 kilometers per second, pretty modest, well, you see that line kind of shifts back a little bit, but it's okay still. You pretty much always form at least 300 such subhalos that meet these requirements. So let's just go crazy and turn the decay velocity up to 30 kilometers per second. And you can see you basically now form very, very few halos which meet these constraints. Most of the small ones have been completely unbound and just fall apart because of this energy injection. And a lot of the others now fail to make this criterion because you've lowered their central densities.
So how do you do the computation within an extended precession? Basically, you make halos disappearing around the tree or decreasing the mass according to the decay time?
So we build the tree, and then as we go along that tree at each point in it, we know how long that halo has been around, essentially, so we can do the decay calculation, figure out how much mass it's losing and what its density profile is at each point in time. And then you just track that all the way to redshift zero. Mm-hmm. And then you have essentially a full catalog of subhalos with masses and density profiles that have been affected by this decay.
But if you do have that decay, wouldn't you change your merger tree?
Yes. So at some level, I think that's true, right? But I think it's going to be, for the kind of timescales that we're talking about here, if you made the timescales very, very short for K, then I think that would be a serious problem. You know, if it was a billion years, you started to decay a lot of that dark matter at early times and just increase the general velocity dispersion, you would definitely change, you know, the linear power spectrum probably, and you would change the way that structure formed and collapsed. In this case, the kind of timescales we're looking at, it's more that you're forming the halos, they're collapsing it, and then you're either modifying them or causing them to dissipate after they formed. So yes, absolutely, at some level it will affect it, but I think providing the timescale is longer than the characteristic timescale for the formation of structure, which is, you know, of order Hubble time, I don't think it's a big effect.
So the free streaming scale, I guess, corresponding to this kick velocity, I mean, this velocity, I guess, is like 10 to the minus 4 of c, I guess, right? And so
right.
Like the scale would be, I guess, 10 to the minus 4 of the Hubble scale, which is like 10 gigaparsecs or something. No, I mean 3 gigaparsecs.
Yeah.
So it would be, so 10 to the minus 4 of that, which is like
0.3 megaparsecs, right?
Yeah, so that's the free streaming scale, right? Yeah.
Right.
Like, so you'd be affecting like the power spectrum, you know, on scales of like the Milky Way. Even.
Right. So, yeah. So this is a very extreme case, and you can rule this out based on other considerations besides just the local group dwarfs.
Right.
When you start getting down to these much smaller scales, I don't think that's quite as true. Much lower velocity scales. But I'll show you in a second that a lot of this parameter space is ruled out from other considerations, such as Lyman alpha forest, cluster mass functions, if you want to get up to really high velocities. So yeah, I mean, I think there are many ways of constraining this, in addition to looking at the local group dwarfs. So let me just put up the sort of constraint plot that you get. So here we have kick velocity, decay time, and the green region here was actually, in an earlier paper that Annika wrote, ruled out by observations of groups and clusters, where you look at both the cluster mass function. So obviously, if you make the kick velocity extremely large, then you just wipe out clusters and they're gone. So that's inconsistent with what's observed. And from groups, you can constrain it using the concentration mass relation, because you lower the concentration of halos, as you pump energy into them.
If you're pumping energy, it's going into the gas too, so you're heating the IGM?
Not really. I mean, so this is all in the dark sector, right? So you're putting energy into the dark matter. The gas will rearranging the dark matter, which will cause the gas to rearrange at some level as well. But you're not directly heating it.
But these other particles aren't thermalizing.
No. Right. Although that's an interesting case to look at as well. If you do have something which can directly couple to the gas and heat it, that would be an interesting question. That's something we're looking at, that Arif and I are looking at as well. There's some interesting models to look at there. The yellow region is then what you rule out by looking at the dwarf satellites. And this pink region is still allowed, so you could have a particle in there that's not ruled out by any of these constraints. Like Neil said, there are other things you could look at which might start to rule that out. And of course, the scales here kind of make sense. The characteristic velocity of local group dwarfs is 10 kilometers a second or so. So you expect to rule out here. You never really rule out anything above about 20 to 30 billion years, just because then the decay time is too long and really nothing interesting happens. I mean, at least from these constraints.
So why Kerouac early on is tau 100 million years? I mean, so you would just decay all that matter inside a certain radius, right? You would just completely decay. So it's
decaying to dark matter.
Right.
Dark matter to dark matter.
Yeah.
So you only change the mass in a certain radius by actually heating dark matter, not by.
Right. The change in the actual mass is negligible, because the mass difference between the X and the Y particle is very small. So you have effectively the same mass of dark matter, it's just that you've given it this extra energy. In these cases down here, you basically destroy any halos even before they really form. This is a case, this is getting to the regime where I think you really would modify the growth of the structure in the first place. But in any case, you wouldn't form dwarf galaxies if you didn't form the subhalos to start with. Let me jump onto something else. So I wanted to give sort of a slightly better view of what this toolkit is actually doing when it evolves a bunch of galaxies and dark matter halos. So I have a couple of animations which show that sort of more graphically. So I'm going to show you three different views of an evolving system of dark matter halos and then their galaxies. So the kind of raw data that you feed in to this kind of model is essentially a set of 4D tracks of dark matter halos through space and time. So what you're looking at here is the formation of a Milky Way type, Milky Way mass dark matter halo, this little white blob in the center. And all of these strands moving into it are the positions in 3D space of all of its progenitor halos. So for example, this one here, you can trace the evolution of a progenitor halo through space, and each point on here corresponds to a different time. So it's a sort of taking the four-dimensional distribution and collapsing it into 3D space. And I'll show you a different representation, which is what the code actually works with, where you treat the same data now as a merger tree. So now time is running up the screen here. And you'll see that the code basically works by evolving each of these halos forward in time until it gets them all to the present day, forming galaxies as it goes along. And then I'll show you the sort of a more standard representation at the end, where you just have the 3D positions of all of the dark matter halos at redshift zero, with sizes scaled to their virial radii. And then I'll put in the galaxies there as well. So I was going to show a Milky Way size halo first. So this is the sort of 4D evolution tracks view. This is taken from the Millennium simulation, by the way. So you see this nice set of formation tracks as these things all merge together to form this big halo at the present day. And then this morphs then to the merger tree view, which is what the code actually uses. And you see it evolving things forward in time and solving the galaxy formation physics as it goes. And then finally at the present day, you have this nice 3D distribution. This turns out actually to be something not too dissimilar from the local group. You have this binary merger almost about to happen in this case. And just a few subhalos. It's low res because it's the Millennium. And then this switches over to looking at the galaxies in there. Galaxies are really small on these scales. It's kind of annoying. They don't show up well. You'll see better in a second in the cluster. But these galaxies have, you know, masses, sizes, luminosities, everything you'd expect them to have in addition to all of these spatial properties.
Why don't you just enlarge them by some factor?
Well, you can do that, but then I'm going to show you the I'm going to show you a galaxy cluster, and if you do that there, then they all start to overlap and look crazy. So
you mentioned before that you form 500 luminous satellites on the Milky Way in this model.
So this is taken from the Millennium simulation, which has relatively low resolution. So those previous ones were done at much higher res. Okay, so let me stop that one and basically show you the same thing, but now for a galaxy cluster. So now things look much more complicated because you can actually resolve a lot more of the substructure. You see all this very complicated sort of interlinked web of hierarchical merging. This is the 4D view again. And you see this big cluster that's going to form by the present day. So then this is now looking at it as a merger tree, where you see things will start to evolve forward, again, evolving the galaxy properties in place as that happens. And now you're left with this big cluster potential and lots of, in this case, a few hundred at least, subhalos embedded within it, each of which will have formed a galaxy. And we'll switch over to that view in a second. And yeah, it actually looks something like a galaxy cluster. Yeah, here we go. So again, all the usual properties you'd expect, luminosities, morphologies, gas content, so on and so on. And you can do this for, these are just two trees. Obviously, you would do this for large samples of trees, whether you want to just look at clusters or a wide range of masses, depending on the problem.
Sorry, what you added here to the Millennium was your visualization?
So what's added here is to take the Millennium as an input of the basic dark matter structure within which galaxy formation is going to happen. Millennium's dark matter only, right? And then to take that input in that merger tree representation and evolve it forward in time, and as it goes, solving the baryonic physics.
So the trajectories are from Millennium too?
Right. And you can do it without recourse to a simulation at all if you want. You can just build trees in a statistical manner. The Millennium has the advantage of giving you spatial information, so it looks prettier if you make an animation.
So independently of Galacticus, probably every simulation would want to have a cool plot like that, just using your visualization.
So you can plug in whatever simulation you want. Yeah, that's just a standard format that you feed it in, and it will go and process that.
This looks like a free.
Yeah, this is Nick Naden's code, which is an extremely nice, extremely good for doing this kind of visualization. And Nick was really super helpful in fixing a bug in it last week when it wasn't working. So
in this visualization, the position of this galaxy is on the position of the subhalos of the Millennium.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Not the subhalos, because you said that you cannot handle subhalos, which
should. Right. So there's no treatment of the physics of subhalos right now. So you won't get. I mean, because you're putting in the Millennium, if you put in a bound pair of subhalos, for example, they would continue to move with each other because that's all solved inside the Millennium simulation. But there's no interaction between the modeled and the code. So the two galaxies that form in those subhalos wouldn't know anything about each other. That's not a fundamental limitation. It's just, the way the code is currently set up. So I wanted to just very quickly show you some standard diagnostics because, it's all very well to have a nice galaxy formation code, but if it doesn't give the right answer, who cares? So the sort of standard things we look at in this game, this is the stellar mass function, stellar mass, number of galaxies per unit volume. The sort of light points here are from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and the yellow line is predicted by the model. You'll see it's not a perfect match. I'm actually running a big parameter space search right now to try and find models which do better here, so right now it predicts too many very bright galaxies. That probably means I need to tweak the AGN feedback. And too many, slightly too steep at the faint end, at the low mass end, sorry. So probably need to change the supernova feedback. But it's clearly getting in the right ballpark here. The star formation history of the universe, star formation rate per unit volume versus redshift. I'm not quite so happy with. I'd like it to be maybe a little bit higher at high redshifts, and I particularly don't like that it doesn't have this nice sharp cutoff at low redshifts. Again, that's probably related to the AGN feedback. The parameter space is large, so it takes a long time to search it. I'm sure we can find a model which works better, but not too crazy. Tully-Fisher relation. So again, the light points here are from the Sloan. The yellow points are predicted by the model. You see that it gets the slope right. The scatter is pretty good. It's clearly offset to somewhat lower velocities. And I think that's related to the fact that right now the galaxy sizes are not quite correct. They need to shrink a little smaller and spin up a little. But yeah, it's pretty close.
But the slope is fine, you're saying?
The slope looks, I mean.
So what's the reason? Like
what's the reason for getting
Pitcher, yeah,
like, the correct slope, you mean? Or?
Yes, what's the origin of Pauli Pitcher?
Oh, well, I mean, it's a trade-off between the usual sort of virial arguments, but then the changes in mass-to-light ratio and baryon content as you go from, you know, low-mass galaxies up to bigger ones, right?
So is that put in by hand, is my question?
No. So,
being provided,
so it's a fairly natural consequence, I think, of so I should say that these models were, in the parameter space search, were chosen to try to fit the stellar mass function and the star formation history of the universe. If you get the right stellar mass function, that constrains the model quite significantly. So, you know, limits what mass of galaxy you have to put in what mass halo. Once you've got that, and if you're getting that right faint end slope, which is really controlled by the feedback, then this seems to come out pretty naturally. So, it, you know, it's a consequence of the relative scaling of baryon content versus halo mass. And so I think in answer to your question, no, it's not put in by hand. You could treat this as, this was not used as a constraint, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Slope is dependent on the band?
I haven't explored it in all of the bands yet, so I don't know.
So there is a strong dependence, but that may be, you need to model dust, I think.
Yeah, so this includes the effects of dust in there. I mean, Tullyfish is always a little difficult because the samples are chosen in, they tend to choose very specific galaxies which, you know, look, have nice rotation curves and things. So this sample's a bit better for that. But yeah, then you've got to correct to face on magnitudes and everything. And it's, so there are a lot of details. Yeah, I wouldn't worry about small offsets in the slope given the complexity of the observational data sets. But
also the amplitude, which is significant.
Yes.
I mean, usually this is a usual problem that you fit luminosity function but not the Fisher. And you
right.
said that, well, you can change the disk size, but are you sure that, I mean, you can also fix it by putting objects in different halos, but then you don't get luminosity.
But then you don't get the luminosity function. I mean,
but it's the same usual tension, right?
So this is the kind of tension that has been seen in other models as well.
Okay, so your velocity is not based on like the dark matter halo potential, it's based on actually like...
This is actually based on calculating the contribution to the rotation from both the baryons themselves and the dark matter, including an adiabatic contraction calculation. So yeah, it's as realistic as we can do. But a whole adiabatic contraction thing is
But you underestimate the velocity, whereas I remember,
right.
Remember there, Aaron Dalton was saying that you actually cannot have any adiabatic contraction based on the same time Fisher.
Right, that's...
Saying if you have adiabatic contraction, you overestimate the velocity.
Yeah, so I mean, I think what that tells you is that you can't really make statements that are that definitive, right? Because there's too much flexibility. If all you're looking at is, you know, the luminosity function and this to move things around. I think as you start to lock down these models by comparing to a lot of other data, you know, halo occupation distributions, you know, whatever else you want to look at, it will become more clear whether this is really just a generic problem. And the other thing you have to do is actually explore the parameter space. There are multiple parameters you could vary here. And nobody has really done a sufficiently thorough job of searching the parameter space to convince me that there isn't a model which actually works.
What about this work that the Lukasz group was trying to push, trying to do
Bayesian
right. analysis?
Yeah, exactly. And so we've done similar things as well, and we've basically done a test case where we try to fit to some of the luminosity function data, varying a lot of parameters. So you can certainly do that. We're in the process right now of repeating it, including, you know, this and other constraints to really search that parameter space. The problem is, even though these models are fast, when you start wanting to search, you know, over 12, 13 parameters, yeah, it takes a long time. So Neil Katz did it by restricting to just a few data sets and having a very simplified model, which allows things to go faster. Yeah, for example, they didn't calculate luminosities, so they couldn't actually compare to something like this. Although, I mean, if you re-express this in terms of stellar masses, they could probably try to make use of it.
What would it take to calculate one model?
So that's a good question. So, I mean, it depends on exactly what you're trying to calculate. But something like this, this code was not designed for speeds. This would run in 1 to 2 hours. A lot of other codes, semi-early codes, are much faster. But I think the goal here was to try and solve things much more carefully, solve the physics more carefully. And I can talk more about that because there are many caveats to that statement. I'm not convinced that it's actually all that much slower if you match physics and you match the accuracy of the solving. You can easily, of course, in this model, you can just turn down the accuracy that you require of the ODE solver and it will run faster.
How many CPUs for that time?
Oh, that was just on one.
Yeah.
It's
parallelized. So.
Yeah, and it's right now it's parallelized in the sort of naive way of just sending one motor tree to each thread that you have. So for large numbers of trees, it scales almost perfectly because you just farm one off to each one. If you're in the regime of having a smaller number of trees where your time is dominated by perhaps the most massive one, it doesn't scale as perfectly, obviously. I'm working on a version which would allow you to have multiple threads working on a single tree at the same time, and that would get around that problem, I think. But it's more complicated.
To answer Fang's question, Andrew has an email waiting for him. My student's running, I think, 100 merger trees in 24 hours.
I think they're actually running 500, right? Because they're running 100 per decade of mass or something.
Oh, okay.
I think that's right, but yeah. Yeah.
So the scatterers are different, right, between galactic listening data?
I haven't actually gone in and measured this carefully. These are just showing the one sigma, the root variance and the model points. This is just plotting individual data points from the Sloan, obviously. So yeah, I'm sure they're not perfect, but my point here is basically to show that the scatter is not either tiny or way, way bigger. Yeah. I'm basically still at the stage of making the first order comparison here. So.
What is the relationship? This is model that you're using?
So right now, this is based on Charlie Conroy's FSPS code. Again, you can feed in whatever you want again. I mean, this is the same answer as always. So I have data sets from both Mariston and Bruzois and Charlot that you could also feed in their stellar population models. It's set up by default to use Charlie Conroy's just because it allows you to choose whatever IMF you want or multiple different IMFs, and it will recompute the spectra of the stars for you. So that's, of course, another factor in there, as is the IMF. This uses a Chabry IMF. If you use something different, you're going to get slightly different answers on here, of course. And I guess very quickly, here are a couple of other things. This is now just turning in this into luminosity space, or B-band luminosity function. Here you can see the effects of dust. So dust is pretty important in the B-band for getting a good match here. K-band. You see the same kind of problems. There are slightly too many massive galaxies, somewhat too many faint ones. Kind of the same level of agreement. This is something that Arif and I are looking at. This is the black hole mass spheroid stellar mass relation. So there's clearly a nice relation in the model, and the scatter is not unreasonable, but it's somewhat too flat compared to the data, which you'd want to be more up here. So we're looking into this. This is also, we think, related a little bit to the sizes of the galaxies not being quite right. It's probably also due to the fact that this just assumes Bondi accretion for the black holes, which is almost certainly not the correct physics. So this is something we're looking into. How long do you want me to keep talking for? I have more to go on.
People stop hearing.
Sounds good to me. So I actually have a couple more things left anyway. So.
Oh,
right. Yeah, pressure's on. So So this is another example of some work that we've been doing with this model. This is with the Pana Venkatesan. We're interested in the question of cosmological reionization, and in particular, observing it primarily through the 21 centimeter emission. So looking at the looking at 21 centimeters in emission or absorption against the CMB. And of course, people have looked at this before, but what we wanted to do was to come back to this problem with a much more realistic model of the galaxy and AGN population that's responsible for the reionization of the universe. And in particular, this is again taken from Nick Naden's webpage. This is an example of one of his simulations where you see these nice cosmological ionization fronts growing around high redshift sources. And we want to be able to compute their evolution, essentially. So these are potentially observable, like I said. They also have consequences for galaxy formation. You know, if you're sitting inside one of these big ionized bubbles, you experience a very different environment than if you're outside of them. So we'd like to be able to look into that. And so basically what we're trying to do, and we've done the first stage of this, what we want to do is to look at the propagation and growth of these cosmological ionization fronts for a realistic and self-consistent set of sources. So you can do the best job possible of modeling reionization and then look at what the observable signatures might be. And yeah, so we're putting in all of the usual physics of recombination, photoionization, heating and cooling rates, also importantly the X-ray contributions, so heating by secondary electrons, and also time-dependent evolution. So around each source, you have an evolving source, and around it, an ionization front grows. And if that source switches off, that ionization front will recombine and collapse. So we basically right now just, we've built this on top of the galactic code. Again, you can just add in a new component, in this case, an ionization front, feed in the differential equations, and it will go and solve that. And right now, we've just done some simple cases to test that it works. This is a case where you have a source consisting of population three stars in an AGN. And showing you as a function of physical radius, this is a redshift 10, the ionization fraction in various species. So we have H2, helium 2, this one's helium 2, and then helium 3. And this is 10 million years after that source switches on. And you kind of see what you expect. You've got an ionization front which has grown out to about 100 kiloparsecs with this little transition region of helium 2 at the edge. You'll notice that there's actually some sort of weak tail of low ionization out to somewhat larger radii. That's due to the X-ray photons which can penetrate further into the intergalactic medium. If I evolve this on for another 90 million years, it just keeps growing outward. And just to test that this is all working, we've been looking at cases. This is now back to the original version, the original plot that I showed you. You can see what happens, for example, if I just artificially remove the X-rays from the source. And you'll see that the ionization front itself stays in more or less the same place, but this tail of low ionization is suppressed, just demonstrating that it was all caused by the X-rays. And we can go ahead to 100 million years. And if I go back again to that first version that I showed you, but now remove the AGN, so all we have left is pop three stars. You'll see now that these things produce a much softer spectrum, so this is a very, very sharp edge then to the ionization region. And again, if I run it down to 100 million years, you start to see the inner regions recombining because these stars have evolved on this time scale and don't really produce any significant photons that are capable of ionizing, doubly ionizing helium.
What do you do for clumping?
So right now, this is just putting in a clumping factor, so a boost in the recombination rates and cooling rates. And like I said, this is spherical symmetry. In principle, you could generalize it further. I think for now, we're going to stick with that. It does have a density profile, so there's an NFW-type density profile surrounding each source. But yeah, just a clumping factor. And then, of course, you can compute 21 centimeter signals based on. So in addition to those ionization states, there's also you can compute the temperature structure and the radiation field at each radius. So you can compute this change in the brightness temperature at 21 centimeters. It depends on how big the AGN is and what population of stars you have. Like I said, these are just example cases. The goal now is to actually run this for a large cosmological representative sample of halos and galaxies. and then compute correlations and power spectra of this quantity. And hopefully based on a much more realistic and detailed model than has previously been done. So the question that usually comes up when I give talks on semi-analytic models, and I think people here are more educated than the average audience perhaps, but the question is, well, why should I use one? Why shouldn't I just go and do a hydro simulation and actually get the physics right? So I think I'll spend just a minute addressing that question. I think the answer is really kind of obvious. It's all about using the right tool for the right job. So here's what a galaxy looks like. If you want to make a galaxy that looks like that, by all means, go and do a hydro simulation. Because if you really want to get all of this beautiful spiral structure and all of the detail, the radial profiles, then that's really the only way you're going to do it. And even then, you might struggle, right? And you'd be putting in physics subgrid, perhaps, which isn't necessarily well understood, and you could think of as being somewhat semi-analytic anyway. But actually, most galaxies we look at look more like this. Yeah, this is a typical-ish Sloan galaxy. Sure, you can see some structure, but it's really kind of a fuzzy blob, and high redshift galaxies are even more so. And in fact, often what we're dealing with is things like this, a large redshift survey of galaxies where galaxies are treated as points with properties such as luminosities, emission line strengths, whatever else, and you want large statistics. And that's really where the semi-analytic approach is good. You can simulate things like this relatively rapidly with a lot of physical detail, and you don't need to resolve the detailed structure and dynamics of individual galaxies. So it's really, you know, using the right tool for the job, not going overboard. I think the crucial thing is, in either case, to understand the limitations. All right, these models are approximate, just as any model is. You need to understand that, and in particular, and this doesn't always happen in the semi-analytic world, but it should, it's a test robustness. Are the results numerically converged? What are the uncertainties in some of the input physics, and how do those propagate through the results? I think that's something we should be trying to do more of. And I'll point out as well, since I got a first draft of this paper in my inbox this morning, statistical comparisons between semi-analytic and hydro simulations show excellent agreement. So with Mike and Gabriella, we've actually looked at this in the past and showed that cooling rates between different models, different semi-analytic models are pretty good, and we're hopefully going to now compare them in detail with hydro simulations. I've been working with Richard Bauer and Rob Crane on comparing to some of Rob's SPH simulations. And when we actually match the physics in his simulations and our semi-analytic code, so you're actually putting in feedback in the same way and getting the same outflows, for example, the two models show excellent statistical agreement. You know, in terms of, say, the stellar mass function, they look almost identical. Of course, neither of them looks like the real data because these SPH simulations don't get the right answer, but they give the same answer. And that shouldn't really be surprising because in the end, they're solving the same physics. So providing you solve it, you know, accurately and you're putting in the same physics in the first place, you really should get the same answer, at least, you know, up to the limitations of either model, of course. Okay, so the final thing I wanted to show, and this is just showing the model in sort of a different light, is some work I'm doing on with the Caltech Cornell Atacama Telescope, or CCAT. So this is a proposed 25-meter submillimeter telescope that will be, not surprisingly, built down in Atacama, in the Atacama Desert. We hope that eventually we'll have up to a square degree field of view. It won't have that at first light. That's going to be somewhat later on, but it has the capacity to go up to that size. So this is sort of a survey submillimeter telescope. You can map hundreds to thousands of submillimeter galaxies per hour. And also, it will have the ability to get redshifts based on CO molecular emission lines, so you can actually start to do real redshift samples of large numbers of submillimeter galaxies. And it operates in the 200 micron to 3 millimeter wavelength range. First light is, well, at least right now, scheduled for like 2016, 2017. And one of the primary goals of this telescope is to do high redshift galaxy science. You know, to figure out what are the submillimeter galaxies, what masses of dark matter halo do they live in, how do they connect to other populations of, you know, optically selected galaxies, for example. And not a lot is known about them right now. So my job in this collaboration is to essentially build some virtual universes, virtual CCAD universes, that contain all of the properties that we expect to be able to measure, and that will allow us to go in and say, well, OK, what science questions can we actually answer? What will the errors be? How accurately can we constrain the halo occupation distributions of these sources, for example? So that's what I'm working on. And I'll just show you sort of a very simple representation of that. This is work with John Carpenter. Basically, we're shooting light cones through the Millennium simulation. So you take a 1-square-degree field of view, shoot it out through that simulation back to very high redshifts, and find all of the dark matter halos that fall within that cone. So you might just be able to make out, you'll see more clearly in a second. Here's just the first chunk of that cone, starting from the observer here at the origin. This is the line of sight. And you'll see these little green dots, which are dark matter halos. Of course, the cone is very thin at this point, so there's not many of them. And I'll show you a projection on the sky as well. So this is what you'd actually, the distribution you'd see projected onto the plane of the sky. And so we shoot this light cone out. This is the next chunk of it moving out further in redshift. And you start to see large-scale structure here. If I go all the way out to about redshift of 1, you can really see this nice cosmic web. So each of these green dots is an individual dark matter halo. You can just keep going. And then what we do is to run the Galacticus model on each of these and calculate the population of galaxies that they contain. And then we take each of those galaxies and run it through the Grissel radiative transfer code to figure out extinction by dust and also the re-emission of starlight that's been absorbed by dust, heated that dust up, and then gets re-emitted. So we can predict actually a full SED for every galaxy that forms, that lies within this light cone. So this is just an example galaxy. This is this SED from the UV all the way through to the radio in this case. So this is the total emission. And I've split this up by the starlight, the diffuse dust shown by this line where you see all the PAH features, and then the molecular cloud component. So this is very detailed spectrum. This is the big thermal emission bump from the dust, which is what CCAT's actually going after. Depending on the redshift, obviously, it's going to kind of span this peak. And so you really get this full multi-wavelength view of each galaxy in there, and then we can start to calculate whatever luminosities and fluxes we want from these. So this is very much a work in progress, and I don't normally like to show results from work in progress, but I know this is just too cool, so I'm going to do it anyway. This is galaxy number counts at 850 microns. So just number of galaxies per square degree on the sky brighter than a given flux. The points here are a compilation of observational data. And then the yellow line is what we get from these virtual universes. And it's a little noisy still, just because we've only done a small part of that cone. So I've scaled it up to the full square degree volume. But you see, it's actually in pretty good agreement with the data. And this is in stark contrast with what other similar models have found in the past, where they failed to get enough galaxies. Now, there's no weird IMFs or anything going on in here. So I can't tell you exactly why this happens right now. I'm working eagerly to figure it out, why we get this different answer.
This is a normal IMF.
Sorry?
This is a normal IMF.
This is, again, just a Chabry IMF, yeah. I suspect that part of the reason that this does better is just because of the more careful treatment of gas and dust, and in particular how it flows between disk and spherical component in the galaxies in my code. But I can't demonstrate that yet, so that's something I'm trying to figure out.
And you didn't lens them either, right?
No, there's no lensing in here. You could put that in statistically again, or actually just tracing through the simulation, I guess. I think it would only make a small difference.
Make a difference, yeah. All the people seem to be claiming that lensing.
Right, so I've seen various claims of that, right? I mean, but I think it's only really at the brightest end here that it would make a significant, even a moderate change.
Yeah, I mean, all the lens sources are going to be at fluxes above 20 or 30.
Right. So it's all these guys.
Yeah. But it's not that many sources are blind. It's only really affects the population where there are not many sources, and so it's the ones that are really magnify that are sensitivity.
But it decreases your sensitivity limit, so you're expecting to be influenced. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, so it's steep out there at 20.
Right, so that, so you take a lot of things from here up into here, right, But down here, it's not a big effect. So it's not perfect, though. If you look at the redshift distribution, this is a redshift distribution of, I think, sources brighter than 2 millijanskis, if I remember correctly. The solid line here is observed sources from Eric Staga from the Shade Survey. And here's what the model predicts. So You have the right number, but they're offset to lower redshift. So this is, yeah, it's not perfect by any means.
So this is the same model you were showing us before, in the same combination of
So yeah, there's a lot of things to understand here.
But also this redshift distribution, what did you like pick out the colors and actually, I mean, how are those redshifts measured?
So you mean the observed ones?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
The ability to measure redshifts might not be uniform.
So well, that is certainly true. I mean, so this is, so I know that this is essentially a best fit probability distribution to their sample.
Real redshift.
Yeah, so they're not measuring precise redshifts for every galaxy. So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it could be very biased by what waveband you select those
right.
solutions with. And I would expect that would be like way below stuff in elevator, so it might be actually skewed to lower redshift than maybe with the true population.
Wouldn't it be possible for you to emulate the way those
ranges
are?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of what we want to do is to apply real observing strategies, you know, to these samples and uncover that kind of bias.
Because it wouldn't surprise me if the ranges were worse.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. So that's right. So yeah, I mean, so I'm not losing too much sleep over this, at least not at this stage. But yeah, just so I don't claim that the model fits everything. I want to show that. So that's basically it. Like I said, the model is freely available. You can, go find about it on the website. You can download it. There's a feed with all of the updates. You can connect with it on Facebook and Twitter. It's very Web 2.0. It's actually really useful. An interesting question. We can try that. Yeah. So if you actually want to go and get the code and play with it, there's a download site. All of the links are real links, so if you grab the talk afterwards, you can just click through them. The whole revision history, all of the updates are on Launchpad. It will also run in the cloud. I have an Amazon machine image, so you can just launch one of Amazon's machines, have it pre-compiled, ready to go. And you can launch 100 of them, and it's
just... Can you pay for that?
No, I don't pay for that. No.
Who pays for it?
I pay to store the machine image on their servers, mm-hmm. Which is pretty minor. If you want to run it yourself, then you pay to use their machines.
Right.
Yeah. Right. They're actually pretty cheap. But, you can get like an 8-core machine for whatever it is now, 70 cents an hour or something. It's not crazy. They actually have a really nice research grant program too. So I've gotten, several tens of thousands of hours out of them. And then the documentation, you can go look at the manual. If you download that, don't be freaked out that it's 600 pages long. The last 500 are all of the nasty details of the interfaces if you want to modify
things. What's the total number count of parameters?
That's a very good question. It's very large. If you're talking about parameters which are actually physically interesting, then I can tell you that when I do Monte Carlo parameter space searches, I vary somewhere around 15 parameters, which is pretty much all the ones that are interesting. There's a whole lot of parameters that control outputs and what filters you want and all that kind of stuff. But physical ones, somewhere in that regime. And that's neglecting things like cosmological parameters, which pretty much fixed, right? So, yeah. And there are sets of input parameters available online, which are known to work pretty well and give you sensible answers. So you don't have to kind of make up your own. You can just go grab a default set to work with. So that's pretty much all I wanted to say. So thanks for listening. And if there's any more questions, feel free to ask. I'm going to be around until at least tomorrow afternoon. So. No, it's all GNU compilers. So, and I haven't tried it with other compilers, but I see no reason why it would have any problems. It's all very standard code. Right now, it runs on version the 4.4 version of those compilers. It will get upgraded pretty soon to the 4.6 version. I've been actually working with them. It breaks the new compilers pretty frequently when you try to use it on one of the development versions. So I've been working with them on version 4.6 to actually fix a lot of the bugs and get it to compile and run correctly on there. And that's pretty crucial because that's the version that the OpenMP code works with. So yeah, it's basically ready to go with that, and we'll run multi-cores now, so. Yeah?
So you said in your CDM models, you get, say, 500 satellites in the Milky Way in the high-resolution simulations. Is that using the same set of parameters that you use to get the global galaxy luminosity function essentially correct, or is that just...
So, yeah, so I can show you some results later on, which have all those details. In the dark matter decay models that we were running, we wanted to take the approach that you kept everything as conservative as possible, because you know, the bane of any kind of dark matter constraints using astrophysics is that astrophysics is messy. So we basically just said, let's place a cut on halo velocity. And above that, we assume that they form stars, and below that, we don't form any stars. And we don't care how many stars they form. We'll assume that even if they form just one star, it's going to be counted as being visible, to give us the highest number of visible subhalos and the most conservative constraints. So in that case, those parameters sort of didn't come into play, essentially. We used a simpler calculation. Okay?
All right.